And I knew what I wanted to call it, and I'm glad I did call it that. It's called The Obvious and the Absurd. The danger is that you'll find half of it obvious and the other half absurd. But maybe not. So here goes. And I will finish, I trust, in ample time for you to object. Everybody thinks he's an empiricist. An empiricist is somebody who believes that knowledge comes from experience, through the senses, you know, at least most of it. What we taste and smell and feel and hear, and above all, what we see with our own eyes. You know, that's how you know. So we say, I know, I saw it myself. We talk about an eyewitness, a first-hand observer. We say, you can't deny the testimony of your own senses. And I like the phrase, seeing is believing. It's very difficult to persuade people that believing is often seeing. That you often see what you believe. We see, in other words, what we expect to see. We believe in advance is there, and that's all we see. There's a very famous experiment that was conducted some years ago, which psychologists took a deck of cards in which it was a perfectly normal deck of cards, bridge cards, except for the fact that the hearts were black and the spades were red. They then showed those cards to people, to experimental subjects. Not, you know, they didn't ripple them, they just showed them fast enough for the person to identify the card. It's amazing how many people went all the way through that deck and identified the cards without noticing that the hearts and the spades were the wrong colors. They saw what they expected to see. Some people, it was done over and over again, and they continued to fail to notice. They did experience vague feelings, and you can see how my title sort of fits on that. Is secularism unchristian? I think that's the title. Is secularism unchristian? Secular is a strange word. The secular is the worldly. Secular means having to do with the world. Now, is Christianity anti-secular? Is it anti-world? I think there are a lot of Christians who've long believed that it was. Their concept of Christianity is something that transports us out of this world. Oh, wicked, wicked world. You know, that the world is too much with us. They thought of Christian faith as something that frees you from everything worldly. You no longer want to do things like play football. You know, to say nothing of go lusting after nudity or booze. You know, we know those are the sinful things of the world. Now, I think that notion that Christianity removes us from the world is a very mistaken one. It seems to me that Christianity affirms the world. You don't have to repeat it. Now suppose I tell you that it slid down because it thought it would be more comfortable lower down, because it wanted to find a more comfortable position. I see some of you sliding around a little bit like this, and it makes sense to say that you're looking for a more comfortable position. Why doesn't the book look for a more comfortable position? Well, that's absurd. We call that anthropomorphic. That's a very bad word. When you explain the behavior of something that is not human as if it has the kind of inner life, you know, emotions and purposes that we ourselves have, then you are committing the anthropomorphic fallacy. That occurs when you assign human attitudes to non-human phenomena. Now, that's funny, talking about the anthropomorphic. You know, the only attitudes we know are human attitudes. The only feelings of which we have any direct experience are our own, right? I mean, we don't know how books feel. We do know how we feel, and we think we do. You know, there is no way for me to understand you, your anger, your happiness, your words very often, unless I project my feelings onto you. We do that all the time, don't we? In fact, we say, well, I understand how you feel. by which we mean something like, I can put myself in that position with my feelings, I project my feelings into you, and I, assuming that you're like me, I understand you, I lock somehow, I think I know what's going on. In fact, what happens when we can't do that? When a person behaves in such a way that our own feelings and attitudes and purposes projected into that person don't interpret his behavior, we say, I don't understand what makes you tick. Or usually we don't, we go to somebody else. We say, I don't understand what makes him tick or her tick. If we cannot project our feelings into someone else and thereby understand his behavior, we will be afraid even to address the person. We'll go talk to somebody else about it. In fact, in extreme cases, well, we will say, what a weirdo. And in some cases, we will go to specialists in weirdo grading, and we will have the individual locked up. Now, I want you to think about this, because it's very obvious that we understand one another and communicate by understanding our own feelings and projecting them onto others. The reason that an unsocialized child, there are a few cases of children who have been deserted by mothers or kept in attics for years, well-documented cases, who came to be 7, 8, 10 years old, and they were not human, they knew no language. They also did not have any capacity to understand other people, because they had not developed this ability to understand their own feelings. So they had no tools with which to understand others. They were locked in a private little world of their own. Well, now you say, okay, sure, it's all right to understand human feelings. To apply human feelings to other humans. The anthropomorphic fallacy consists in assigning human feelings to non-human objects, right? That's the anthropomorphic fallacy. Okay, what about dogs? And we say to a dog, shame. And what happens to the dog? You can see him ashamed. Tail goes down. Or do you see it? What do you see? You just see the tail. No, that's not shame. Fear? You see fear in a dog? You see joy in a dog? Delight? Happiness? What do you see? Well, a lot of people say it's okay with dogs, because dogs are man's best friend, maybe woman's too, and they're somewhat like us. But I want to remind you that it was not okay to do that with dogs to some prominent thinkers in the 17th and 18th centuries, who concluded that dogs, I won't explain how they got there, although maybe at the end of my remarks you may be able to reconstruct for yourself how they got there. They decided that dogs were mere machines, and consequently you could do anything you wanted to a dog and the dog would never feel it. And so they would practice what we would call the most horrible cruelties on animals and not worry about it, because the dogs were mere machines. If I pound on that canopy up there, or if I kick my drill press, you may say I'm stupid, but I'm not being cruel to the drill press. Well, you say, well, gee whiz, what was the matter with those people? Wasn't it obvious that the dog was in pain? The dog yelped with pain. No, you didn't see that. You saw the dog yelp, or you heard it yelp. But pain was something you read in. Do you assume that when a door hinge squeaks, that it's squeaking with pain? Why do you assume that a mouse that you're holding by its tail is squeaking with pain or fright? We do assume that, but some very prominent thinkers of the 17th and 18th centuries thought that was absurd. What about plants? A plant is alive, isn't it? We all say that. Can it therefore feel? Does it feel? Some people say yes. Does a plant enjoy a good pruning? The way Carol Hinderly enjoys a sauna and a back rub would seem to me at least equally cruel. You know, the plant seems to prosper afterwards, as does Carol. How can we be sure? Can we be sure? You know, we are sure, as a matter of fact. There is no society for the prevention of cruelty to plants. If someone were to bring a case into court, it would be thrown out immediately. But there is a society for the prevention of cruelty to animals, and people can be prosecuted successfully for practicing cruelty to animals. Do our senses really provide satisfactory evidence for our confident assertion that dogs and humans feel, but pine trees and peonies do not? And, you know, after all, you say a plant likes sunshine. Look how its leaves plaster up against the window in order to get the most sunshine. Look how the sunflower turns to always have its face toward the sun because it really likes the sun. The way someone in a swimming suit will turn on the grass out there to get well done on every side. There's a lot of evidence that plants have purposes. We talk about the way the roots will reach for the water. Are they really reaching? Or is that just a way of speaking? Is that just the anthropomorphic fallacy? What's going on when a little plant sprout that's been buried under a sea of asphalt for a parking lot before the soil has been sterilized, it just pushes and pushes and pushes and finally breaks through? You see, it's hungry for sunlight. It's trying to reach the sun. You know, the way you would reach for air if you were locked in a box. No, that's just a way of speaking. Or is it just a way of speaking? How do we know? Why are we so sure? What's obvious? What's absurd? Now, of course, it's obviously absurd, isn't it, to say that two atoms of hydrogen combine with one of oxygen because they want to create some water. That's absurd. Whatever is true of humans, and probably dogs, and maybe even plants if you stretch it a bit, is obviously not true of atoms. Atoms have no attitudes, no feelings, no purposes, no preferences, obviously. They behave as they do because... Why do they behave as they do? With atoms, molecules, rocks, planets, tables, pencils, swimming suits, and everything else which we put in the category of inanimate object, we do not ask why in the same sense as we ask why about the behavior of humans, and sometimes dogs, and occasionally plants. When we want to know why a rock behaved as it did, we always ask about events in its past. However, when we want to know why a human behaved as he did, we sometimes, not always, sometimes, usually, ask about events in the future. Thus, we see a human being go off a truck, and we say, why did he jump? Notice the assumption here. He jumped, meaning he had a purpose. Either he thought there was a fire in the truck, or he was going to have an accident, or he was trying to show off or something. However, we could view him as being pushed, too. But a rock is always pushed. If the rock falls off the fall, see, the rock always falls. Human beings can either fall or jump, right? Human beings can either fall or jump. Because we are made up of inanimate stuff, we can also be pushed. But human beings have two ways of behaving. I mean, two kinds of causes are relevant to human beings. One is because of something in the past that pushes us. The other is because of something in the future which we want to attain. Now, you can use either type of explanation. The woman who handed me the Bible, you could, if you wanted to, say, my words hit her ears and passed in and excited some nerves to respond. You could treat it in terms of stimulus and response, couldn't you? And some people want to do that. They think they can and should explain all human behavior the way in which we explain the behavior of rocks, and I'll come back to that. But it would be absurd to think of a rock as jumping from a truck. Now, why would it be absurd? We say, well, it's because a rock is just an object. It doesn't have any purposes. In fact, the word inanimate means without an inner life, without an anima. An anima is an inner principle that can motivate. I want you to notice that we have divided our world into two parts. Now, I want you to think about that. If you don't think about that, and if you don't agree with that, fine. I think you do agree with that. If you think about it, you'll agree. they're kind of our metaphysics of the playground, our common sense, the way we work in the world. We've divided our world into two parts. There are two kinds of stuffs out there. And we're not sure just where to draw the line of distinction, you see. We're not certain that plants are a problem for us. Only one problem, but the main one. But we're positive that people go into one category and rocks go into another. But our difficulties with plants do not shake our absolute conviction that some beings have purposes that explain why and other beings do not. Now I want you to reflect for a moment on that division of the universe into beings with an inner life and inanimate objects. What are molecules and atoms and subatomic particles? Well, by our common sense rules, it's obvious that they are inanimate objects. But science tells us that everything is made up of molecules, atoms, and subatomic particles. Everything, including us. And so, everything, well, it follows then that beings with an inner life, like ourselves, are entirely composed of objects without an inner life. Does that give you any problems? How does life, and especially inner life or consciousness, arise out of the combination of totally unliving, totally unconscious particles? Here's my problem. Our experience tells us that mind exists. At least it tells me that mind exists. I'll come to some people whose experience does not tell them that in a moment. It also tells us that matter exists. I find mind and matter out there in the world. Matter is inert, inanimate, and dead stuff. Now, how does mind get into matter? I mean, you're a piece of, can I poke you? You're a piece of matter, see? Nice matter. And there's mind there. Now, you can't see it, but she'll testify to it. How are they related to one another? How do they touch? Where did that mind come in? At what point did mind sneak in there? Now, sensible people don't bother themselves with problems like that, of course. They leave those problems to philosophers who have nothing better or more useful to do. If you don't give philosophers problems like that, they persecute students. So, but you know, now I'm very serious about this. Philosophical problems do not disappear simply because we don't think about them very much. What they do instead is they go down underneath in funny little ways, come out like chicken pox. They itch, and when they itch, we scratch, and when we scratch them, they sometimes get infected. And I think we have a bad case of infection from some of the itches that we have scratched as a result of our division of the world into mind and matter. My metaphor is going to get confusing, so I'll drop it and switch back to ordinary language. The obvious distinction between mind and matter was not always obvious. It is obvious to us, but it was not always obvious, and there are still cultures of the world where it isn't obvious today. To some people, it is obvious that everything is alive, that everything has an anima, a spirit of its own principle motivating it, and that everything which occurs happens because it was willed. Okay, you've read about cultures like that, primitive cultures. We call those people animists, and we chuckle, of course. Animists and animism are found in primitive cultures, very quaint. Anthropologists study these people and even try to preserve them the way we preserve cucumbers in sealed jars. Pickled animists are delightful to read about. But they are obviously victims of primitive thinking. But there are other people who also do not believe in the distinction between mind and matter, whom no one calls primitive. They conclude not that there is no inanimate matter, but that there is nothing else. Arthur Lovejoy, the author of a book called The Great Chain of Being, very eminent historian of ideas, once said that the human mind has a tropism for the belief that all is one. And so I suppose it was inevitable that once we came to the conclusion that everything is not alive, we had to jump to the conclusion that nothing is alive. Anyway, that's what the best minds of our day are inclined to argue, that there is nothing but inanimate matter. There is no mind. Mind, they say, is a primitive concept which we have carried over from our animist days. Science has shown and is showing that so-called mental phenomena can be reduced to physiological phenomena. In other words, to complex behavior of nerve cells, especially the behavior of that extraordinarily intricate wiring system called the brain. And they like to speak of the brain as a wiring system. these nerve cells are, of course, ultimately reducible to chemical processes, and research is going forward to show how they can be explained as in terms of chemical processes. And those chemical processes can finally be understood in terms of the laws of physics. And in physics, there is nothing but matter and its motions. Ultimately, then, there is only matter. That's the argument. Now, absurd as it seems at first, it's all obvious once you begin to think it through. Then you realize that mind, purpose, consciousness, and a whole host of the concepts that we have applied to our own behavior are really illusions based upon our ignorance. I don't believe this now, and I want to try to present it persuasively, with keep my sneer to a minimum. According to these people, you see, for a long time we did not know how chemical and physical processes controlled our behavior, and so we assumed they did not do so. And then we invented terms like mind and purpose and free will in order to explain what we otherwise couldn't explain. Just as pre-Copernican and pre-Galilean and pre-Newtonian people who did not understand how the laws of matter controlled the planets, they assumed that the planets chose their motions on the basis of some innate preferences. And they went sort of, the lighter things are higher up and lighter things are more perfect, and more perfect things prefer more perfect motions, and the circle is the most perfect motion. All anthropomorphic by our standards, but lacking any other understanding of why these things behaved as they did, they fell back on that one. But once we came to understand how the laws of physics control planetary motions, we were able to junk our primitive animism and replace it with scientific explanations cast exclusively in terms of the laws of matter in motion. And now they say the same process is occurring with respect to human behavior. We are learning how the laws of physics control all of our behavior. Soon, we will be able to junk our primitive animism, under which we assumed that people had minds and wills and purposes, and we will replace this with scientific explanations cast exclusively in terms of the laws of matter in motion. I trust you know someone who argues this way. I'm not going to supply any names, because some of these people have staunch defenders, and I don't want to take their names in vain, but B.F. Skinner. Best known one. Now, I cannot call this position absurd because, as I did with the animist, because the inanimist position is finally held and is firmly held and argued for by many of the best minds of our time. And I find that interesting. The best minds of our time. You have to ignore the paradox that the best minds are saying there is no such thing as mind. But that's presumably a mere verbal problem. Ignore also the paradox that the best minds argue this position. And now, arguing, it seems to me, requires some kind of mind out there to be persuaded. But maybe not. Maybe that's just another semantic problem that will somehow clear out of the way. But you must, if you wish to be modern and in step with the leading thinkers of our time, you must abandon the concept of mind, because science has shown it to be useless for purposes of scientific explanation, and therefore it is obsolete. You must accept the scientific point of view. Why? Well, because that point of view has proved itself. It's been vindicated time and again through a steady accumulation of knowledge and through the growing power to control the world that science has placed in our hands. Now, don't ask me what knowledge means in the absence of minds to do the knowing. And don't ask me what it means to be able to control in the absence of any purposes. I can't answer those questions because I'm not a believer. I am an empiricist. When I'm told that I must not read mind into observations of behavior, that we do not experience anything that can be called mind, and these are quotations from some of the leading behaviorists. When I'm told that our senses reveal to us nothing but matter in motion, nothing but behaviors, and that it is illegitimate, unscientific, and primitive to go beyond the testimony of our senses, then I say Bull Shoals, which is a dam in southern Missouri, or northern Arkansas. Really, I mean, the first thing I experience is my consciousness. The most real, vivid, and primary knowledge I possess is knowledge of my own will, purposes, inner life. If valid knowledge is based upon experience, I cannot accept as true anything that requires me to deny my most basic and persuasive experiencing, the experience of my own consciousness, feelings, purposes, desires. That is, for me, the most real thing of all. I mean, frankly, you have a kind of secondary reality for me. I believe you're there. I really do. I believe you're there. But the thing of which I am most sure is that I experience, that I have a mind, a consciousness. I don't know how to describe it, but it's the thing into which you all come. A funny thing happened on the way to the 20th century, and I'm almost done. In the 16th and 17th centuries, people began to abandon the notion that planets and rocks must have purposes simply because human beings have them. We abandoned that notion. We decided that part of the world was material, merely matter in motion, mindless matter moving meaninglessly. So people set out to discover the laws of its motion, the mechanism, and I stress the word, the mechanism of the world. The concepts of mind and purpose seemed useless for this task, and even misleading, so they were dropped. Starting with the assumption that everything material was mere matter, and that the behavior of matter could be exhaustively explained in terms of position and motion, this way of thinking led to the magnificent achievement of the Newtonian universe. That's what Isaac Newton did for us. The universe was a mechanism, like a clock. And Alexander Pope, when he wrote an epitaph for Newton, suggested that, I don't think it ever went over his grave, but his epitaph, I think, expresses the mind of the 18th century. Nature and nature's laws lay hid in night. God said, let Newton be, and all was light. It was a tremendous achievement. But mind was altogether left out of Newton's system. Newton wanted it left out. Mind was considered something altogether different and something just as real. Newton's system was only supposed to explain matter, and there was the other whole realm of mind. But already in the 18th century, there were writers who were pushing it further. Baron de Holbach, the best known one, who argued that it is, quote him, it is to physics that man must have recourse in all of his investigations. He must consult it in matters of religion, ethics, legislation, political government, the sciences and the arts, even in his pleasures and sufferings. Nature acts by simple, uniform, and invariable laws which physics enables us to know. The laws of physics will ultimately explain everything. Now, that view, not widely held in the 18th century, came to be much more widely held in the 19th. And though it remained mere propaganda for a while, there were several events, including some accomplishments of science itself, that helped to push it into an actual program. I will mention one, Darwin's Origin of Species, which took something that for a long time, a lot of people have been sort of held out of this mechanistic process, and explained how life itself was brought into existence and could be understood in terms of the operation of processes of natural selection, purely inanimate, upon genetic material, purely inanimate. You didn't need any concept of force, purpose, elan vital, or anything like that to explain life itself. It was a terrible blow, of course, to a lot of conservative thinking and humanistic thinking in the 19th century. Or Freud, who comes along and reaches into the deepest recesses of mind and emotion in order to persuade us that every human phenomenon, from love to religion, is a product of mechanical processes, biological mechanisms. Freud was a complete biological determinist. Now, as the 20th century matured, it became axiomatic among enlightened people, that means it became obvious and undeniable, that all is ultimately matter, and matter is mindless material moving meaningless. Now, I submit that this view is very hard to accept in ordinary life, and we don't. And when we go out of our philosophy classes, we stop thinking about it, and we go over to the dining hall, we go back to our old dualism, because it's convenient. A crude kind of dualism under which, you know, we do science and we philosophize and we think things through to their logical conclusion by one set of beliefs, but we fight and eat and make love and crack jokes by another set of beliefs. But I think, and this is the reason I'm talking about this morning, I think that we are growing increasingly restive and uneasy under this practical dualism. Now, I submit that this view is very hard to accept in ordinary life, and we don't. You know, when we go out of our philosophy classes, we stop thinking about it, and we go over to the dining hall, we go back to our old dualism, because it's convenient. We a crude kind of dualism under which, you know, we do science, and we philosophize, and we think things through to their logical conclusion by one set of beliefs, but we fight and eat and make love and crack jokes by another set of beliefs. But I think, and this is the reason I'm talking about this morning, I think that we are growing increasingly restive and uneasy under this practical dualism. I think we are growing increasingly unsure about the reality and the value of that other world. Is it not all mere illusion? You know, if we know that ultimately there is only matter, and matter is mere mechanism, it's hard to take seriously our own passions and aspirations. When we know that these passions and aspirations are nothing but the complex products of very tiny, tiny billiard balls that are whirling eternally and clanging together and accidentally producing things like Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, Shakespeare's sonnets, and you know, my own feeling of at a snow-capped mountain. It's hard to take it seriously. Of course, there is still God. Rene Descartes, who did so much to set Western thought on this track that I've described, kept God in reserve to patch up the holes. Particularly, he kept God in reserve to get mind and matter together, because he couldn't see how they could be brought together, so he had God do that. But, you know, science, since Descartes' time, has done such a fine job of hole patching that we no longer have much use for the hypothesis of God. You know, when God is merely the one who is in reserve to patch up the holes that our scientific knowledge can't patch up, God becomes increasingly irrelevant. And I think for the religiously inclined person of today, God is often rather distant, extremely vague, and highly irrelevant to ongoing life. That may not be true of very conservative people, but I think for them he often becomes the great magician, who though he once set up the whole show, imposed rules and set it rolling, he now interferes in unpredictable and unexplainable ways. You know, and that's the reality of God, is his power to interfere. I notice that this is a viewpoint which still makes God irrelevant to the ongoing process of life. If everything ultimately happens because bits of matter are blindly bumping, who needs God? Except for those, you know, infrequent and debatable interferences. You know, when I was sick and the doctors had given up hope and then God intervened. And notice what happens then to God. As soon as they say, aha, we discovered here that there was a virus that overcame that virus, then God becomes irrelevant for that purpose too. Then the extension of psychosomatic medicine is ruling God out of the healing picture very, very rapidly, if you have this point of view. Now, let me ask one other question, because it's Christmas. How are we to understand the incarnation? Well, we don't understand it, you say. That's a good pious statement. It's a mystery. But that, I think, is an evasion. You know, we don't completely understand the incarnation, that God became flesh. We don't completely understand that. We don't completely understand anything. But the doctrine of the incarnation has meaning, and it has intellectual content. It does. That's why we can talk about it. The way we grasp that meaning and intellectual content is the way we understand the incarnation. Now, we can do that very simply. I'm not saying you may not. You can do it very simply as the shepherds are reported to have done. They simply worshiped. Or you can do it in terms of a very complex philosophy, as the author of John's Gospel does. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God. Or as is done in the Epistle to the Colossians. These are trying to explain and understand, get a grasp of the incarnation in terms of a complex philosophy, a metaphysics, a way of seeing the whole world. It is fitting the fact of the incarnation into the author's philosophical worldview. Now, I don't believe that you can reconcile the Gospel of John or the theology of Colossians with the assumption that the material world is merely mindless matter moving meaninglessly. I don't think you can reconcile. Maybe you can. I can't do it. But that's no problem for me, because I'm on the last page, for one thing. But that's no problem for me, because I find that point of view that I've been describing absurd. Unsupported by evidence, false to important areas of experience, and thoroughly irrational. As I see it, everything is in some sense alive. Everything has its own inner life, its own purposes and feelings. There ain't no such thing as inanimate matter. You will probably find that absurd. I find it close to obvious. I do not believe, I want to assure you this, I do not believe that rocks or molecules are like people. There's a little man inside each rock. That's absurd. You know, that's human imperialism. That's the anthropomorphic fallacy. To assume that because something participates in something that we participate in, it's got to do it just like us. You know, we practice that fallacy with other people, too. We say, you're crazy because you don't feel the way I do. I don't, you know, I see how... pick on myself. I don't understand how those kids can like that awful music. I'm assuming here that taste is like mine. Of course, it is awful music, but that's I don't believe that I find it absurd to claim that rocks and molecules are exactly like people, but neither do I believe that they are wholly and altogether unlike people. A rock and I are made up partly of the same materials. In view of the well-known and universally accepted fact of the interdependence of everything, of the production of plants out of minerals, of animals from plants, of minerals from animals, it would be absurd to claim that between me and water there is an impassable gulf of pure difference. My consciousness, my inner life, my feelings, purposes, are the complex products of a highly complex organism. But that consciousness, which is the most immediate and undeniable fact of my experience, must be present in some simple rudimentary form in the simplest components of matter, or I should not have it in this highly developed form. I think that's obvious. And that the whole universe is alive, obvious. Or do you think that's absurd? Don't applaud. I don't know what applause means. You've been brainwashed, or you weren't listening, or you... I'm glad some of you didn't applaud. What do you think? I would like you to spend a little time thinking about it so that you can zero in on the basic weak points and not some of the frilly ones.
Are you dismissing spirit then as
No.
A factor?
No, I don't dismiss spirit at all. What do you mean by spirit?
That which we attribute to the God that we are talking about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, all right. What does spirit have to do with body? So what does your spirit have to do with your body? That's what a question I would ask you.
Well, I'm trying to put this in perspective on what you said, huh? You're saying that life exists throughout all matter.
Mm-hmm.
What is the force that combines it in the proper proportions in this complex organism that makes it the spirit?
I still am puzzled by what you mean by spirit.
I'm taking that philosophy to accept as religion, which is saying that the man, or this particular animate object, has a relationship with God which is unique, and that is his spiritual attribute.
Well, maybe one thing, I don't think that man's relationship with God is unique. I think we must be very careful about that. And you can cite scriptural authority against me, but I have some scriptural authority on my side, too. I mean, after all things exist by the word of his power. If the whole creation has been groaning in expectation, waiting for its fulfillment, and we are simply, the firstborn, sort of the leaders of the parade, and we're just sort of the spearhead of the creation, then whatever it is, I think now I know where we're disagreeing. I think you're suggesting that spirit is something unique to man. That's when you use the word spirit, that's what man has that's unique. Yeah. Well, that's what I was afraid of. See, I don't agree with that. I think that it's a matter of degree. But I'm not sure. Carol's hanging around somewhere. You're probably waiting on me. The New Testament word for spirit, spirit, soul, I don't think they have their contemporary meanings. See, what I'm afraid of, and this is the thing, what I'm afraid of is that we get caught in this world that I described. We get persuaded that the behaviorists are right. Our behavior is completely determined. We can't reason our way out of it. It works. Physics seems to explain everything. The laws of physics, which assume that everything is mindless matter, moving meaninglessly. It seems to explain everything. And then we're concerned about such things as our free will and our personalities and our destiny and all that. And so we reach out and we grab something, we call it spirit, and we pull it in here. And we say, we got it. And what is it? Well, I don't know what it is, but it's what we got. And that's an example, I'd say, of kind of dualism that I think tends to break down. I think that under the assault of science, and by the way, I'm not anti-science, and I don't really see science as making an assault, but to a person who has this view that that every advance of the behaviorists or every success along the path toward the creation of life in the laboratory, to a person who sees all of these as threatening, which I do not, this is an assault. And I think under that kind of feeling of assault, our sense of the reality of spirit diminishes. You sort of gets weaker and weaker, and it's kind of what's left. And we try to go, and then we go to church on Sunday morning to try to get a spiritual transfusion, to give us enough something or other to last through the whole week when we're going to be subjected again to the laws of matter. I don't know whether I'm being fair to you or answering you or missing you. Or,
I was trying to understand.
Yeah, I think it was a good question. Somebody? Yes.
How would you answer a teenager who has just really been studying Darwin's theory in school, that's really hung up on it, you know, in terms of what the Bible is taught and what it's been taught in church? What's the answer to that person in terms of what you said?
Oh, boy. Yeah, that's very complex. But that's one of the reasons, another one of the things, again, that disturbs me, is I think that for some kids, I've done this kind of counseling with freshmen. I teach at Southern Methodist University, and a good number of these kids come out of conservative parish backgrounds where they have been taught that Darwin was a fraud and that evolution didn't really occur. And there's a phrase, science falsely so-called, that they like to throw around. It's kind of a giveaway. And I find that there is very difficult to work with them. I have finally one standard approach, and I'm not sure it's responsible, but I use it, because the other approach fails. I'll tell you what the other approach is in a moment. I tell them that I am a Christian, and I tell them that I accept the theory of evolution fully, and I'm making it. Now, I don't know. You know, that's a kind of a witness. What I'm telling them is that, I can survive. Maybe you can, too. Because the question they're asking is, am I going to survive? They come with this faith that is, unfortunately, I think, propped up upon certain articles of bad science. And if those articles of bad science are kicked out, they think their faith and all the meaning of their life is going to collapse. And I want to tell them, no, those things can be kicked out, and it won't necessarily collapse. Hang in there. Be of good courage. Kind of a desperate remedy. But the thing I try to do is get them to change their metaphysics. I think, Darwinian science came along in the 19th century into a metaphysics it was a metaphysics of a view of the world in which the thing that gave meaning to life was the fact that life itself was immune from these laws of physics. So when Darwin shows that it can be explained in terms of the laws of physics, collapso. There's some brilliant books on this, some brilliant articles, just describing in detail, for example, in Victorian England, what happened, what went on in the religious periodicals, even in church parish papers, the reaction to this. And you see these people, they have prepared a line of defense, and with the advantage of 100 years insight, we can see that line of defense wasn't going to hold up at all. The only line of defense that is held at all, and it's one the anti-Darwinians arrived at late, was the notion that, well, what religion and art and humanity and spirit deal with is values. What they did was they consigned to science the whole realm of fact. They gave up. In fact, what they've been doing was, it's saying there's certain facts science explains and some facts religion explains. Then science explains some more, and they back up. And finally, religion's got almost no facts left to explain. So some people said, chuck it. It's a continual retreat. Science explains all facts. Religion explains values and meaning. I don't like this at all, because values and meaning are rooted in fact, or they're useless. And that kind of separation of the world, I think, has also contributed to the impoverishment of meaning, to this sense, a pervasive sense of 20th century life, that the humane in us is being ground down to a nubbin. I'm sorry, I have a feeling I'm not, well, did I answer your question at all?
Partly.
There's some good books. There's Langdon Gilkey has written a fine book on this question. There's another one that's been edited by some guy with a funny name that I can't think of. But there are good books dealing with this. Yeah, Bruce, I don't know who is next. So Bruce.
Do you fit the concept of evil into this as a uniquely human thing, or does evil exist? Or?
Yes, evil exists, and it's not uniquely human.
Okay, I mean, you were talking before about how a human isn't unique. There isn't a unique thing in which you're saying a human spirit. So does a human choose evil, choose to do evil in a way that a rock doesn't choose to do evil?
A rock, no, I think a rock chooses to do evil. Now, careful, I don't mean that when a rock falls off a cliff and bashes you on the head, it's a naughty rock. The evil that a rock chooses to do is not discernible by human beings. That is, at a level of being that is beyond our apprehension. And we certainly can't treat it as if it's a human being. It that dirty rock stubbed my toe, that sort of thing. So it doesn't make much sense to talk about the evil that rocks do. However, if you see everything that is, as I do, glomming on to the world about it and pulling in aspects of its experience. See, everything is experiencing. These glasses now are sitting on my hand. They are experiencing my hand. They're experiencing the air above them. They're actually made up of very small particles that are coming into existence and fading out of existence and perishing, leaving something behind them. And all of those little drops of experience are glomming onto other pieces of experience, and they're doing it in a selective way, and that's why we get change and creativity and novelty. And what is evil? It is an inappropriate glomming onto the past, or an inappropriate combining of the past into the future. Now, it's much easier to talk about it in human terms. In human terms, evil is to be out of step with the way things ultimately are and ought to be. And
Well, okay, you have a battle between the red ants and the black ants, and you have a battle between the Nazis and the Allies or anything like that. What is the difference between those two battles?
Oh, gee.
I mean, is there any evil involved with the red ants and black ants?
I don't know. Oh, sure, there's always evil involved. In the ongoing, as long as the existence is continuing to adventure, there's evil. But I'm not going to pass judgment on the red ants and the black ants. If I do so, I very quickly do it in my own terms. And that's dangerous, too. I think a lot of the ecological crisis has come about from our eagerness to impose our values upon the rest of the creation. People who say that, there was someone up here a couple of years ago who said the world is full of evil. He was preaching kind of pessimistic philosophy because he saw all those trees falling over and dying in the forest and red ants battling black ants and maple rot affecting the maple trees. The world is full of evil, and the flower comes up and perishes in the snow. It's hit by the frost. I don't see that as evil at all. I think that's the anthropomorphic fallacy. You can only conceive of evil in human terms. I don't see much point. In fact, I see no point at all in talking about evil at the non-human world. There is the evil that I can most, really the only evil that I can comprehend in an adequate way is evil at the human level.
Yeah.
And I really have quite enough to do to worry about my own. I can't even be too concerned about yours. However, I do, which is a part of my evil. Yeah, well, I don't, I mean, you know, any, it seems to me that any language that we use in speaking about God is inadequate. It limps, it's symbolic, it's anthropomorphic, and yet I think it does make a good bit of difference which language we choose. Now, there are some people who want to get rid of personal pronouns in speaking about God, particularly the masculine personal pronoun. And maybe there's something to be said for substituting the feminine. I would not like, and while it is of course true that God does not have gender, God does not have a personality in the sense in which we understand ourselves to have personalities, so if God needed to be socialized, or God have your Freudian an ego, an id, and a superego, nonetheless, why do we want to speak of God as personal? I think a good part of the explanation is that if you want to take God seriously, you cannot help but speak of God in personal terms, because a person is that within our own experience which really addresses us seriously. You know, a person, when I want to be serious about an obligation, I have to talk about persons. The obligations that I have to things just do not have that ultimate seriousness. The Jewish philosopher theologian Martin Buber has, I think, written more movingly and adequately on this than anyone, on the necessity of speaking of God in personal terms. It is an expression of the reality of God and the utter seriousness of the claim that he makes. See, and I'm using he makes. I could say it. The utter seriousness of the claim that it makes on our life. But one problem with it is that as soon as I say it, it hooks into this whole Newtonian metaphysics again. And nothing in that Newtonian metaphysics can be taken with utter seriousness. That's all mindless matter moving meaningfully. It doesn't give a rip. It doesn't care about us. Out of the Bible. That's where our culture got it, out of the Bible. Where we got a lot of our other notions of God is out of Greek philosophy. And they don't always jive too well. You know, out of Greek philosophy, we learn to assign to God all kinds of metaphysical complements. The holy other, well, no, that's not fair, that's not right. The unmoved mover, you know, pure being, and all sorts of things that make him irrelevant. But the Jews talk about God as doing things, caring, being grieved in his liver or his kidneys, and repenting and becoming angry. Their God is involved in the ongoing process of life. Now, I'm not saying that was based on another metaphysics. I'm not saying that the Jewish metaphysics was perfect. Yeah, but you ask, where do we get our concept of God from? I think most of the good things in our concept of God come out of the Hebrews. Most of the bad things come from the Greeks. Is that... that's a sort of a cheap answer, but... and I don't... you're not happy with it. That's a sort of a cheap answer, but you're not happy with it. It's okay. Don't be happy. You and then